Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for more traditional exercise such as weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447. Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
May 27, 2015, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, the Clintons' relationship with the media. The first wave of Hillary Clinton's emails from that private server are released to the media, including a bunch about what happened in Benghazi. We'll talk about what they show about her relationship with reporters, and we'll talk about journalists' relationship with the Clinton Foundation, including the different reactions from George Stephanopoulos and Judy Woodruff about the revelations each made personal donations to that foundation. Doing more with less, the New York Times notifies filmmakers and studios that it's going to cut back on its movie reviews, no longer guaranteeing to review every theatrical release in the city. We'll talk about why some documentarians and independent filmmakers aren't happy about this, and how being on the job can impact a journalist's mental health. The Huffington Post took on that issue, publishing a multi-part series looking at PTSD, anxiety, and depression among those in the news industry. But let's start with the drama over at the cable channel TLC around the program 19 Kids and Counting, and a story in Touch magazine that revealed child molestation accusations against the eldest Duggar child, Josh Duggar. According to a 2006 police report the magazine obtained, Josh Duggar confessed to fondling five young girls when he was 14 years old. Here's part of how that story was reported on ABC's Nightline.
On the show 19 Kids and Counting, Josh Duggar and his family are portrayed as the picture of wholesome perfection. Now that show has been pulled, as Josh faces accusations he sexually molested underage girls when he was a teenager.
This is the story of my family. We're the Duggars.
For years, the Duggar family has been portrayed on their TLC show 19 Kids and Counting as a wholesome Christian family with old-fashioned values.
All right, let's all hold hands here, okay?
No TV, modest dress.
This one for the double date.
No cursing, and above all, no premarital sex.
We decided that there was going to be no kissing before marriage.
But now they are a family under fire after allegations surfaced their oldest child, Josh Duggar, had inappropriate contact with several underage girls beginning when he was 14 years old.
The family presented itself as the perfect all-American Christian family. And all of a sudden, one of the most salacious things you can imagine, which is child molestation, goes in and people can't help but look. It's like watching a train wreck.
It is kind of like watching a train wreck, and it's one I personally haven't been able to pull away from this week. Lots of people out there love the Duggars, and just as many, if not more, don't. And a lot of the talk this week has been quite critical of the family and of its beliefs and its actions. Interestingly enough, one of the voices trying to bring some balance to the conversation, gay rights activist Dan Savage. Listen to what he had to say to MSNBC's Chris Hayes.
And the other thing I think to remember, and you know, I've been following this on Twitter and online, there's, I believe, a discomforting expression of almost unalloyed delight on the part of some people that I agree with politically, people on the left, I'm on the left. We have to remember as we talk about this that five little girls, at least five little girls, were abused and molested, and there's nothing here to take delight in or to celebrate.
Yeah, there. I 100% agree, and I also have seen that tone creep in some places and found it pretty gross.
So Savage has a good point here. So we're going to do our best to keep this entirely to how this story was covered, how it came out and was unfolding over the course of the last week or so. This isn't anything that's truly new. These accusations have been out there for years. Anybody who had ever Googled, you know, the Duggars or Josh Duggar, some of this stuff had been out there. But the real details of it, not until the In Touch magazine article that had a copy of the police report.
Yeah, and I think that we all know from how these things typically play out that where there's smoke, eventually there will be fire. So the story was going to come out. I'm a little disappointed in the way In Touch it was sort of careless in its handling of these police reports, though, because at least the first versions, the unredacted versions, had the identifying characteristics of the young women who were involved. And that's just not right. And so the police department took that upon themselves at the, with the order of a judge, I guess, to destroy those original reports. And not that I'm in favor of destroying information, but that was irresponsible on the part of the of In Touch to publish that information the way they did.
I think Mike is right on this. I mean, it's one of those things where even if you're going to present this as sort of new information, there's still some journalistic ethics that needs to be followed. And one of the things that we've talked about a lot on this program and others is that when you're talking about the confidentiality of children, then in this case, that should have been redacted. There was no need to put those names out there. This happened so many years ago, and now you're bringing it back up because he was 14. They were younger. He's now, I think, in his 30s.
Or 27 or something.
Yeah, late 20s.
Then now you're talking, I mean, that is a long period of time. And now these women who are these girls who are now women, you know, they're now having to face this all over
and
again.
Being so, victimized all over again by having been named there. And there's actually a practice, too, within our profession that a victim of sexual assault, regardless if they are of age, if they are minors or not, that we wouldn't name them. So even if somebody was over the age of 18 at the time of an attack, we wouldn't necessarily name that person.
No, you're absolutely right. Even though we, you know, we, and I say we, I'm talking about we in the media, we violate that when it becomes part of the story. Or we want to sensationalize it. And that's part of the problem I see here is that the story is not about these women. It's about the Duggars and bringing out the issues that they may have in terms of, I guess, the contradictions in the lifestyle that we see on television and things that may have happened 14, 15 years ago.
So since the Memorial Day weekend, here we are recording this program midday Wednesday. There could be, by the time this runs on KBIA during the dinner hour, additional advertisers who pull out, I believe at last count, there were at least three or four who had stepped back, General Mills Cereal being one of them, saying that they didn't want to be furthering this telling of this family's story in the reality TV mode. TLC has at least temporarily pulled the shows off of the air from its main cable channel, yet they do still remain on the TLC website. They also still do remain on cable systems on demand. Programming options. So they are still out there in some way.
It does seem like they're trying to hedge their bets a little bit to see if there's any possibility that this will blow over, but I have a hard time imagining that it will. I mean, basically child molestation, that's just about as low on the rung as you can go. And in terms of PR, that's pretty tough. And already they decided to let go Honey Boo Boo you know, the mother is hanging out with a convicted sex offender. So this is probably even worse than that.
Well, and it's funny, and I kind of saw an article, Honey Boo Boo's mother, Mama June, spoke to TMZ over the weekend and said, and I don't know what this says when on some level Mama June is making sense, but she was protesting herself and saying, and I'm not sure on exactly what grounds she would do this, but saying, I'm going to sue TLC if they leave the Duggars on the air. He's one of the central characters on that program. He has admitted to doing this. The person that I'm involved with wasn't even on the show with me. This is an unfair thing to do.
I think this has nothing to do with fairness or values, and it's all about a lawyer seeing an opportunity and a client seeing an opportunity when TLC is weak. Let's go get them.
Yeah. And I think the other part to this is that you have advertisers who are basically saying, look, we don't want anything that's going to hurt our brand. And if whether it's the Duggars or it's Honey Boo Boo or it's Duck Dynasty, because they had a controversy a couple of years ago, and now that show is sort of wavering. So, I mean, anything that causes these advertisers to go, whoa, hold up, this is going to hurt our brand. They're going to pull back, and then that's when the shows start to have problems.
I think there are a couple of other really interesting little media angles to this, too.
Mike Huckabee next, actually, was the one I was thinking of specifically. This family is very, very heavily politically connected. And as, you know, every conversation, I think every show we're gonna be doing and sitting here for the next year and a half, we're going to be talking about that 2016 presidential race. Mike Huckabee, candidate for president on the Republican side, standing behind Josh Duggar and his family through this and saying, as reprehensible as some acts might be, we need to forgive people and move on.
And I'm not sure, at least in the sort of primary season, that that actually hurts him. One, he's from Arkansas. They're from Arkansas. He's talking about forgiveness. You know, I think it's a way for him to stand out from the crowd. So it may not be all that valuable to Huckabee later, but now it probably isn't hurting him.
Yeah, right now it's not hurting him because, you know, as Mike said, this is the primary season, and he is one of, what, 20 candidates now?
Yeah, so many that they're having multiple-tiered debates.
So, I mean, you're trying to basically stand out from the rest of the candidates, and not to say that this is one way to do that, but to basically abandon the Duggars at this time would not sit well with his constituents.
Maybe, one of those bad attention, maybe better than no attention.
Yeah, exactly.
No,
and the Duggars showed up and spoke at Huckabee events, so it's not like he can turn them aside the way some of the other candidates might be.
Okay, what was another one of those storylines maybe that you had on the list?
This whole police report and investigation comes out based on somebody sending anonymous information to Oprah Winfrey several years ago when she was considering doing a special about the Duggars. And so there's an interesting media angle because Oprah's people turned the information over to law enforcement.
And that was after somebody had caught wind who knew the family, had gotten in touch with producers at the Oprah Winfrey Show and said, hey, don't run this. Here's what you need to know about these people.
And here's the part that I don't understand. If TLC knew about this, why would they jeopardize their overall brand to put this family on? I mean, and yes, it's ran. I mean, they've been out there for a while. They've brought tons of publicity, tons of profit to TLC because of what they've done. But now that's put that brand in jeopardy because of what's come out now.
I mean, and I'm not trying to defend TLC. I mean, to me, it's hilarious that it still stands for the Learning Channel when there's not a whole lot of learning going on there.
Right.
Well, except maybe learning about how not to behave in public. But I have to say, NBC News and CNN and everybody else are all over this Duggar story because they know when they see the ratings opportunity, they're going after it too.
Well, and NBC is in kind of a strange position here. NBC being responsible for producing through the Peacock Productions, which is an offshoot of NBC and NBC News, being responsible for producing some of the specials that have gone on here a couple of weeks before the allegations became as widespread and as public as they are now. Erica Hill sat down with the family and did an hour-long special interview program with them and has since been doing a lot of the follow-up reporting and in that position of having to disclose that in every single segment that, oh, by the way, we're kind of part of this too.
Well, and that's the reality that we live in the cross-promotion and the cross-ownership of various studios and various production houses. So, I mean, this is the reality we live in.
We just spent 13 minutes talking about it.
that we did. So what do you say we talk about a couple of other things that are going on this week? There have been some media ownership changes as we're talking about some of that cross-promotion and ownership. Univision announced it's buying The Root, an online outlet covering news, opinion, and culture targeting the African-American community. Univision execs say they want to beef up their online offerings and build a more diverse audience. And it hasn't been that much time since we found out that Comcast-Time Warner merger was going to fall apart. Well, now we've got word that Charter Communications is coming in to buy up Time Warner and Bright House. The new company would provide cable and internet to some 23 million American homes. Experts say this deal has a much better chance of making it past federal regulators than that Comcast and Time Warner merger. Why is that? What makes this one more likely to happen?
Well, I'm not actually sure it's that much more likely because there's a smaller audience total if you bring these three companies together, but it's still bringing the second, fourth, and tenth largest players in the cable TV business together. That's a pretty huge group. And if you look at what both the FCC and the Justice Department said about the Comcast merger attempt, they're not only looking at whether it'll sort of be neutral in terms of its impact on the public, they're looking for it to have a positive impact or they might turn it down. So I'm not sure that this is going to have any more likelihood of going through than the other one.
Yeah, I'm not sure either, because what it really is going to have an impact on is broadband, because that's really where everything is going. They're not making a whole lot of money on cable right now. It's all about being able to provide that internet Wi-Fi capability across various parts of the country. And if they can control that, I think that's where the FCC and the Justice Department has a problem with just the size and the scope of what's happening here.
Okay, well, go online and you'll see there are no shortage of new movies out there, especially this time of year. And there are also no shortage of places to go to find reviews of those films, sites like Fandango and Rotten Tomatoes. And then every newspaper site in America has movie reviews, too. And we're going to talk about what's going on at the New York Times.
This week's movies, Aloft, The Farewell Party, and Tomorrowland.
So this weekend, the Times had three films in that video wrap. Going forward, that number might go down. Movie critic A.O. Scott sent an email to the publicity departments of the major motion picture companies saying that the paper is going to decide which films to review on a case-by-case basis instead of reviewing everything that's showing in the city. His email said there are just too many movies opening each week in order to keep up. There are only so many films that a single person can go out and review in a week. It's just time runs out. But there are a lot of people really unhappy about this.
Well, you do have some of the independent producers, documentary producers, who are worried that the Times will no longer get around to reviewing their movies. I don't really know that they should be worrying as much as the folks that are going immediate creating these cheesy, video on demand or direct to DVD movies that should be worrying about it, because the New York Times is probably going to continue to review those movies that they think are interesting or popular. And so if you've got a good documentary or indie film, my guess is you're probably going to get reviewed and some of those other folks won't be.
I think it just goes back to the glut of movies that you have coming out, be they short films, be they good documentaries, be they pretty crappy documentaries. You just don't have enough time and you don't have enough resources to go and look at all of these things and write reviews about them and be able to put them out there in a way that actually helps your audience and not the Oscar voters and that sort of thing, because I think that's where a lot of the pushback is coming from.
And that is, it seems like it, that this could hurt certain filmmakers' opportunities to become Oscar eligible.
But the reason is that the Oscars themselves, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, decided as a way to try to rein in what qualified as a documentary or a film to say it must be reviewed by either the New York Times or the Los Angeles Times for it to count in that category. Well, nobody, the papers decided they were going to be part of those judging criteria. So the folks at the Academy are going to have to come up with some different set of rules. But frankly, that's exactly what caused the problem, at least according to some of the folks at the New York Times. Folks would come into New York, they'd rent the cheesiest low-rent theater, show a movie for a week or whatever the minimum was, and then go straight to video on demand or DVD. And that's how they get enough publicity, by getting that review to prop up their sales.
Yes, to me, it's just one of those things where, this is the New York Times basically saying, look, we can't be all things to all people. Mm-hmm. We've tried to do that for a long time. It's not working for us. It doesn't fit with the model that we want to create going forward. So we're going to pull back.
Okay. The State Department released close to 900 pages of emails from Hillary Clinton's time as Secretary of State, detailing how she and the agency handled the terrorist attacks in Benghazi and how she handles relationships with close friends and advisors. There were a lot of them, and there are a lot more coming over the course of the next year to year and a half, that people at the State Department are saying it's going to take that long to sift through the documents to make them public. Some of them had very lighthearted, joking, jovial tones. Some of them had some pretty heavy stuff in there.
Well, I think part of this is, I mean, this box opened up when President Obama decided that he wanted to keep using his BlackBerry. Mm-hmm. And now you have all types of politicians, you have diplomats, that sort of thing, are using those. And they're all open to freedom of information. And the fact that what happened with Benghazi now has brought to light that the Republicans are saying, well, what about these emails? What's going on here? And we want to see those. Now it's opened up everything. And the question becomes, as reporters sift through all these emails, what are they going to find? Right now, they haven't found much of anything. There's no smoking gun that supposedly was there, at least not yet anyway.
The only really sort of seriously, quote, damaging thing that I saw from the email so far has been how Sidney Blumenthal, a friend and a former employee of the Clintons who has worked for the Clinton Foundation, who has worked for some companies that were trying to get business in Libya, was giving private back channel intelligence to Hillary Clinton while she was Secretary of State. That could be damage to this whole question of whether or not Hillary Clinton is truthful or trustworthy or whatever. But I don't think this individual case or these emails by themselves are going to really make a difference in the end. And I just have to say, can I just audibly sigh when I say this is going to be a serious topic, it's going to be a frequent topic, and it's going to become a rather tiresome topic before November 2016, the whole relationship between the media and the Clintons. We have to talk about it, but I'm not always thrilled to have to talk about it.
I'm in the same camp. I'm not thrilled to talk about it, mainly because there's a relationship between – there will be a relationship between whoever the Republican candidate is and the media, be it the right-wing media, left-wing media, whatever you want to call it. There's a relationship between politicians and the media, regardless of who it is. And it's mainly because it's the Clintons, and the Clintons are linked with the liberal media, that we have this.
Okay. Then, since you have both made it really clear to me, you don't want to talk about this anymore. One last thing I do want to bring up, though. Over the course of the last week and a half, 2 weeks since we weren't here last week, this idea of George Stephanopoulos giving all this money to the Clinton Foundation. Okay, fine. It's been out there. Everyone's talked about it. The thing we haven't heard people talk about a whole lot, and I'm interested in, was Judy Woodruff's reaction to the PBS ombudsman who gave her a hard time for having donated $250 to the Haiti Relief Fund, which was part of the Clinton Foundation, immediately following the 2010 earthquake in Haiti, that devastating earthquake. And her response, after being called out publicly by the ombudsman for doing this, was, wait a minute, back up. That's not fair. I was inundated with all of these images, with all of these pleas for help. My humanity crept in there, and I was told that was going to be the fastest, most expedient, easiest way to get actual relief to the people of Haiti was to donate to that specific fund. What did I do wrong?
I hear what she's saying. I disagree with her. I think there is a clear standard that we have to avoid the perception of conflict of interest, whether that's real or not. And I think she would have been smarter not to have done that. She could have given to other groups that were providing Haiti relief that didn't involve politics or the Clintons. Okay. On the other hand, I think it speaks a little bit to the integrity or in the reputation for integrity that Judy Woodruff has, that most people are kind of giving her a buy on this one. First of all, she only gave $250. Stephanopoulos gave $75,000 over the course of 3 years or whatever it was. But I think it also says something about the way they reacted. Woodruff really thinks that there's nothing wrong with what she did. It was a little bit of money. It was specifically targeted to relief. She gave it immediately after the earthquake. Okay, I don't think it's the right thing to do, but I can buy her argument. Stephanopoulos, on the other hand, is basically saying, well, I thought it was a public record, but after thinking about it, then he gave the lawyer response. And ABC News is apparently doing nothing about it except contemplating taking him off of presidential election coverage, which is the least they could do.
Well, I think you're absolutely right when it comes to George Stephanopoulos. I mean, he could have been much more forthright about what he did, when he did it, and why he did it. And not have
and for
to
how
wait.
Long and he for was how doing long it. It's really it. Indefensible.
That's true. I mean, it wasn't until somebody...
This wasn't a one-time deal.
No. It wasn't until somebody said something that he said, oh, yeah, by the way, yeah, I did do this, and I did it over this course. I mean, that's the problem I have with it. But looking at what Judy Woodruff did, I think that what we're seeing here is that when you have politicians or former presidents or senators, whatever, who are connecting their philanthropic organizations with actually helping people, we're going to run into this. Are we going to get to the point where journalists can't give money to these organizations because of what they're connected. And Mike, you're right. I mean, there are tons of other organizations they could give to. But, you know, a journalist isn't really thinking about how is this connected to this, how is this connected to that. They're just picking up the phone and making a donation.
But I have to say, and I am not faulting any of the work that the Clinton Foundation does. What I'm faulting these large media companies. It wasn't just, you know, Stephanopoulos and Woodruff. You have large media companies giving lots and lots of money to the Clinton Foundation. They're not just doing that to be good corporate citizens.
Oh, I agree. I think you're absolutely right. They're not doing it to be corporate citizens.
With
they're
that
doing
comes
it,
access.
They're doing it for access. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And they should be transparent in the fact that they're doing it, or they should stop. But I think one of the things that we're finding out is that as the media becomes more global, as they become more connected to one side or the other, they're going to go to whichever side they feel is going to help them either gain access or gain more connections to the rich and the powerful.
So, you know, one of the things that Judy Woodruff said she was moved by were all of those graphic images and stories coming out of Haiti at the time of that earthquake. Well, the past week or so, there has been a fascinating series in the Huffington Post about the mental health issues that are emerging in American newsrooms. Field reporters developing post-traumatic stress disorder upon returning home from Iraq and Afghanistan, just like the troops that they're embedded with. Producers and editors developing anxiety and depression after looking for hours on end at the same very graphic images that we warn our audiences against before we put them on the air. We've linked to that full series on our Links blog, and I invite folks to take a look at it. This is a real thing, and it's something that here at the School of Journalism, we're starting to think about how we can teach our students early on in their careers how to engage in self-care and to begin to protect themselves against this before they head out into...
A couple of things that I really found interesting about the series. One is that all journalists are susceptible to, you know, the effects of trauma, and that, frankly, some of those journalists who see images secondhand, right, but see them frequently enough, might be more in danger than those hardened, you know, conflict reporters who are out there and kind of get a thick skin or desensitized to all of it. So we need to be thinking about how to prepare all street-level journalists or even editors in the office how to deal with this.
I've spoken on this program before about what it was like to cover 9/11 from the inside of a control room in a television station in Chicago. And being on the air for 63 hours, it took me weeks, if not months, to even begin to process what had happened.
You know, I started reading the pieces in Huffington Post and had to stop because I was a police reporter for a long time. And I started to think about some of the things that I saw as a police reporter, homicides, you know, kids being hurt and injured, both their fault, their parents' fault, someone else's fault. And so I had to stop. I hadn't picked it back up again, but I'm going to try. But I think this is definitely something that we as journalism educators have to really address while our students are learning how to be good journalists.
And as you suggested, we actually did just approve a course that's going to be offered to our students as an elective opportunity to learn more about this.
Mm-hmm. But I also think that the media itself is going to have to do a lot more in terms of counseling. I mean, we don't really look at it. It's just, you know, it's not a part of the culture of
journalism. You're told on the first day of work when you're handed your HR materials, oh, and there's the telephone number for employee assistance, but you never know to use it again.
Right.
Before we go, a quick update for you. You may remember the story of Dave Benton, the Champaign, Illinois news anchor who went on the air and told his audience about his bout with brain cancer. Well, WCIA announced yesterday he lost that battle. Dave Benton was 53. I'd like to thank you for being with us this last half hour. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Pat Akers for running the audio for us. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.